This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zandin for Jane Lindholm. You may not go out of your way to see art, but there's a lot of art in Vermont you don't have to go out of your way to see. Like the whale's tails along Interstate 89, the painted silos on Route 15 in Cambridge, or the beautiful sculptures in Barrie that are a tribute to the city's historic stonecutters. That's public art, and whether it's on private or public property, in front of a business, or at a rest area, it's art that's outside and there for all to see. Today, we size up the public art in Vermont and ask you what there is to see in your town. What's your favorite? Why do you like it? And we'll consider what value public art has. Some of it can be thought-provoking, some of it whimsical, some of it can be flat-out puzzling. What does it add to our state or our communities? Maybe you're an artist who's done a sculpture or painted a mural. What do you want the work to say and add to a public space? Love to hear from you today at 1-800-639-2211. You can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net or even post a comment on our website or at the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Well, we're joined today by Rachel Elizabeth Jones, an art staff writer at 7 Days, and Michelle Bailey, Senior Program Director at the Vermont Arts Council. Thank you both for being here.
Hi, welcome, thanks for Steve. Having me.
So one thing I realized in getting ready for this program is there is a lot of public art out there. The more you look, the more you find. And so clearly somebody sees value in it. But here we are in a state with all – we're surrounded by natural beauty. There's plenty to look at. I'm interested in what each of you feels public art adds to our lives as individuals and to communities. So, Michelle, let's start with you.
Sure. I think that when the community experiences public art, it's really wonderful. What I like to call the random encounter experience, because you don't have to necessarily go into a museum or an art gallery to see art, but it's in your community, in your space where you might not expect to see it. And that's what's so exciting. Think about the typical memorials that commemorate people or places or events. That's a lot of what people think of when they think of public art. But as you said, it can be temporary. It can be provocative. It really brings a sense of some of the most successful public art that I enjoy is stuff that reflects the community and the story of the community. So what is unique about that place that it's settled in. So,
yeah, and we mentioned Barrie, so, you know, that would be probably a prime example because you've got all that great – those great granite sculptures in Barrie. Then you've got the Hope Cemetery, which
of course,
has all of that. Rachel, what's your take on the value of public art to individuals and communities?
Hi, thanks for having me. I think that one of the most immediate thing that comes to mind about why public art is important is that it sort of has the power to kind of knock people out of their routines, right? Like you can be driving to work, or you can, you know, be, I don't know, going to pick up your kids, and you see something, and you know, it provides this break in sort of your day-to-day thought patterns, and then you can wonder about who made it. And I also think that you know, having artwork, whatever form that might take, outdoors or in a place where anyone can see it, really has the ability to sort of get people to think about, oh, you know, art isn't something that I need to go to a gallery to see. It's not something I need to necessarily have a background in. You know, I could maybe come out here and build something, or, you know, it's a public conversation. It's not isolated.
You touch on something, Rachel, that came to mind, which is, you know, we start getting into what we mean when we say public art, and we think of examples that range from really professional work like those sculptures in Barrie to, I don't know, somebody might call – well, I know what I think of is there's a barn up in the Northeast Kingdom. Maybe it's in Granby as a town that's just covered in license plates. A lot of people have photographed it. And maybe it wasn't even intended to be art, but it was created by someone who's maybe not an artist. So, you know, is there a blurry line between what's art and what's not art in the public sphere? Go ahead, Rachel. Sorry.
I was going to say, I certainly think so. And I think that blurriness and blurring that line is what's most exciting about public art.
Michelle?
I would agree. I think that you know, it's something – that's what's so exciting about art is that it's very hard to define. You know it when you see it kind of experience. Or it's just an intentional placement of objects that create an experience for you or a reaction in you that you may like or not like. But it's been an intentional placement of something that – that makes you think, and that's what's very exciting.
We're going to ask each of you at some point to come up with your own favorite examples of public art in Vermont. But we've heard from a number of listeners, both in advance and during the program. We get this comment about a Cold Hollow Sculpture Park in Enosburg. This outdoor display of David Strohmeyer's incredible pieces is one of the lesser-known wonders of Vermont and is completely free to come and wander around the 50-plus sculptures in the beautiful Franklin County countryside. Are you familiar with that, Michelle?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Can you describe
it? I have not been up there myself, yeah. I have to confess, but I do know about it, and it seems like a wonderful way to experience the arts and outdoor sculpture. There have been a number of outdoor sculpture experiences like that around the state. You know, even in Stowe right now, they have the exposed exhibit going on, and that community down in Woodstock, they have Sculpture Fest every year. And so they're down in North Bennington, there's the North Bennington sculpture exhibit that happens. So, and they're rotating, so sculptures come in and out. It's a great way to see lots of different art.
Hey, Rachel, who are the artists who are doing this? Are they artists who generally, kind of specialize, for lack of a better term, in public art? Or they do kind of gallery art too, but this is another outlet?
I think it would depend on which place you're talking about. I think in the case of sculpture parks that are sort of designated, areas for people to walk through and see large scale sculpture, it's largely professional artists with a background, in showing in galleries. But the being able to show work outdoors gives them sort of a different framework to work in, and obviously they have more space. They can make taller, bigger, broader works that maybe even interact with the rural or the woods that show up behind it.
And it's interesting, a lot of the public art is a reflection of its surroundings. It captures something about Vermont, Vermont's pastoral nature, but then there's public art that's sort of meant to be, in a way, at odds with its surroundings. And the whale's tails, Michelle and I were talking about that before the program, that has that element of surprise because it's so unexpected. So is it then impossible to characterize the kind of public art we have in Vermont, Rachel?
I don't think it's impossible. I think it's just come up with certain sort of distinctions, or you say, okay, like this is a piece of vernacular public art that I can see on the side of the road. I don't know. It's just a matter of how much you kind of dig in, I guess, to the past of or the history of that artist. I think that, one of the great things is that you don't necessarily have to do that. You can respond in any way that you like, whether it's, a David Strohmeyer piece. He is the sculptor behind Cold Hollow Sculpture Park, or hay bales that have been painted to look like a Disney character.
The Sculpture Park is a collection of public art, and there are others as well. Rachel, I think you're familiar with Path of Life Sculpture Garden.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Path of Life is in Windsor. It's one of my favorite examples of public artwork. It's arranged in sort of this, kind of a spiritual walkthrough, as the name would suggest. But what I most love about this place is the community sort of vignette is a selection of these massive wooden heads by an artist named Ria Blas, who works and lives in Sharon. I believe she's Dutch, but she's been in Vermont for over 20 years at least. And what she's done is burnt these massive logs, so that the outside is entirely charcoaled, and she's carved really expressive faces, and they're faces of all ages, and using sort of deceptively simple lines, she makes these very funny or sort of melancholic faces that, you know, when you mm-hmm. they're taller than you know, you or I, and they're just a delight to encounter.
That's the Path of Life Sculpture Garden in Windsor. Margaret wrote in to mention the sculpture of Leslie Fry, who Margaret says has several beautiful public pieces around Vermont that are whimsical, talk about the environment, the body, and architecture. And she's also cultivated an incredible sculpture garden, Margaret writes, in Winooski, and has a website that shows examples of her talent. So there's yet another sculpture garden featuring public art. And, of course, we have a lot of paintings as well. I mean, murals, there seem to be maybe countless numbers in Vermont communities on walls and on the sides of buildings. You know, obviously these things don't happen without something going on behind the scenes. They cost money. Artists need to be paid and supported. Generally, who's responsible for public art, Michelle?
Well, it depends on the situation. I administer an Art and State Buildings program where there is funding available for the commissioning of Vermont artists for new or significant state construction. But, you know, there are also private or public nonprofits that will do the sculpture gardens and the exhibits. And so there may be an honorarium or something that an artist is given to put the work out there. It really does depend. So there's a whole variety. Sometimes artists may be asked, and this is frequently asked of artists, to, you know, we always encourage artists to be paid, but sometimes they'll be asked to donate work for a fundraising activity or something. And so there might be works of art exhibited around a community. And so it really runs the whole gambit.
So I don't know if you can speak to this, but when it comes to Vermont Arts Council supporting artists who want to do public work through grants, what are the criteria? What do you look at in making choices? I'm sure you have more artists interested in doing this kind of work than you have grants to go around.
Sure. Well, for through the Art and State Buildings program, we're looking for artists who have experience in creating public works of art, you know, have a background in this, although it's not necessarily required that they do that. But, you know, artists that can work beyond the studio, and when you're commissioning an artist or when you're being commissioned as an artist, you need to be able to work with the client and understand what the needs are in design. You may have to go back and forth before you kind of land on that design that works for the client. And so we're looking for people who can communicate effectively, who will be able to come up with multiple ideas, work in a community setting. And with our with many of our programs, we're really looking for some way that the art is also providing some kind of community engagement as a part of the design process. So it might be that the artist goes out and speak to community members to talk about the history of the place. For example, in Waterbury, we commissioned Sara Lee Turat to do a very large, about 40-foot mural in the new Agency of Human Services building. And she went out and did a lot of research in the community about the history of the state hospital, the history of Waterbury, the history of the site, the types of work that's happening in the building, and the work that she created really reflects those conversations and her work in the community. And sometimes there are other pieces where the community is actually engaged in the art making itself. So,
and then we've got city arts organizations that also support it. I don't know how much Burlington Arts, City Arts does in this realm. Rachel, perhaps you can speak to that.
Sure. The first thing that comes to mind is Burlington City Arts actually just launched their community fund, in which Burlington area artists can apply for grant funds for a project specifically that in some way involves the local community. And in terms of public art, I know that this year in its inaugural year, Mary Lacey, who's a well-known muralist here, was one of the artists who was selected. And I'm sorry, that's Mary Lacey and Sloan Collins together. And they are working on the ONE mural project, so the Old North End, working with specifically with kids and young people in that community to place murals around the area, which I know, there's a couple things going on there. One is, makes sort of the built environment, at very least, you know, more engaging to look at, right? It's fun to walk around. But the other thing is that, you know, when you have young folks who are, you know, actively able to engage with their community in that way, it helps them to sort of take pride, right? They can say, oh, I painted that flower right on that building. Yeah, so that's exciting.
We've got a comment from Charter, who writes, in the Northeast Kingdom, which generally is a minor abyss in the art scene, sculptor David Tenich, I hope I pronounced that right, created jacks and balls that roll over the beautiful hillside on Kirby Ridge. There have been giant tools, wing nuts, and trade materials larger than life on the hill. It is a showstopper as you drive by. Michelle?
Yeah, I have not seen that, but I've heard of it, and I'm dying to get up there to see that. That's the kind of art experience that I love, that, you know, you come across these things in a setting that you don't expect necessarily, and you might be taken aback, or it might make you laugh, or you might think, what is this? So I think that's really wonderful. There's another spot that I have come across in my travels that is another one of those pieces that really makes me smile. And if you head out into the backwoods of Calais, Vermont, and go out near Maple Corner, artist Chris Miller has created this stone truck.
Oh, yeah.
And it's shaped, it's a truck built out of stone with some flowers in the back. And it's just very whimsical. And you come across it, you know, in the midst of these, this wonderful small community setting with dirt roads, and right, it's just not expected. So,
since we're talking about favorites, Rachel, anything come to mind that you'd like to point us toward?
Sure, yeah. One of my favorite places is actually the Middlebury College campus. It's hard to pick a favorite work there. There's at least 24 pieces of public work that the college has put a tremendous amount of deliberation into. It's a world-class collection. Two of my favorites, actually. There's Smog by Tony Smith, which is this very mathematical, geometrical, sprawling sculpture outside of Bicentennial Hall up on the hill there. And it is, you know, it's abstract, but it's monumental, and it just... it's very striking. Another one it's a kinetic sculpture. It moves with the wind. It's called Two Open Rectangles, Eccentric Variation 6. It's a 1976 sculpture by George Rickey. And it's essentially, it's two metal rectangles kind of raised up into the sky, and they move with the wind, and they never touch. And, you know, it sounds really simple, but when you're looking at it, you could probably, you know, just stand there for hours. And I imagine that, you know, some of the college kids probably do. So those are some of my favorites. And I recommend walking around on campus down there.
It's great you mentioned that, Rachel, because we heard from Richard Saunders, who's director of Middlebury College Museum of Art and mm-hmm. chair of their Committee on Art at Public Places, who just wanted to mention that public art collection at Middlebury is the largest and most important collection in Vermont. And he says, among the finest college and university collections anywhere in the U.S., it's free and open to the public. And in fact, if you contact the Middlebury College Museum of Art, there are student-led tours you can get in on, which from what you're describing, Rachel, might be very helpful.
I think so, yeah.
So that's good. Thanks for bringing that up. We are asking about public art today, whether you think it's important, whether there are public art displays that you particularly appreciate. We'd love to hear your examples and your comments at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zinn. This is Vermont Edition. We're talking about public art today, which comes in many forms. We mentioned the barn covered with license plates in the Northeast Kingdom. We mentioned murals on walls and buildings in many Vermont towns. Painted curtains that are in grange halls and old town halls also come to mind as a form of public art. If you've been in central Vermont long enough, you might remember, as I do, the Chelsea Wind Harp high on a hill that was a sonic as well as a visual public art experience. What hidden or not so hidden art comes to mind when we mention public art? We'd like to hear from you on today's program at 1-800 639-2211, or you can go to vpr.net and post your comments on the Vermont Edition page. We're joined by Rachel Elizabeth Jones, an art staff writer at 7 Days, and Michelle Braley, who's Senior Program Director at the Vermont Arts Council. And joining us for a few minutes now is Elliot Katz, an artist who's worked on public sculpture in and out of Vermont. He's the artist behind the Mushroom Grove installation outside the Hilton Garden Inn in Burlington. Elliot, thanks for being here.
Hi, Steve. Thank you.
So you've talked about creating public art as a collaborative process. We haven't touched on this, but I think it's an interesting aspect of public art. And maybe you could just explain what you mean by that.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think as you guys have talked about, responding to landscape and responding to architecture with art, typically that just, for me, means that you are required to build at a certain scale. Like, it has to be pretty large to be not dwarfed by the world. So naturally, that means if it's bigger, it just requires a lot more effort to produce, even if it, you know, at the end of the day, you hope that it looks effortless and, like, free and light and very, like, easy breezy. They usually do, in my experience, require a lot of labor. So in Burlington, I was living in Burlington for probably 9 years after undergrad, and I just felt like it was such an amazing community because there's so many people that know how to make very, like, precision parts, or, you know, the Blodgett oven factory down the road, or I've got a friend, Matt Penny, who specialized in building bicycle frames, and another studio mate, Rebecca Maycumber, who worked for Conant Metal and Light, and she's just kind of a wizard with, like, electric and also finishing of materials. I hired both of them to work on the Mushroom Grove piece and also the brightly colored trees on Main Street, just because I simply couldn't do it all. So it's a, you know, those pieces are sort of not collaborative so much like the murals in the Old North End might be, with kids having the opportunity to participate, which sounds awesome, but they are definitely, they require a lot of knowledge by a lot of different people, like skills I don't have, I had to farm out to friends of mine.
You know, it strikes me that any outdoor art is going to change because it's exposed to the elements. It's going to weather, it's going to age and deteriorate. As an artist, when you're thinking about what you're going to do, does that factor into it?
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
not necessarily even protecting it from those changes, but
sure,
recognizing them and sort of planning for that to happen.
Yeah, I think of that almost as related to a particular culture sometimes. Like, I feel like in Western culture, you know, the land in America, we love shiny cars, you know, and we want them to be, like, bright cherry red all the time. But the reality is, yeah, they age with sunlight, they age with rain and salt on our roads and stuff like that, and they do deteriorate. And yet, I feel like culturally, in me, definitely, I can only speak for myself, I do love the look of, like, a 68 cherry red Camaro soft top. You know, that's still exciting to me. So that's part of it. But then, you know, and I feel like in Eastern philosophy, there's, like, more of a tendency to look at, I guess, object making in a holistic way, so that you're thinking about how things decay as you're making them, and you're allowing that change to occur and not fight it, you know? I guess I read a book, Wabi Sabi, the philosophy of, it's an aesthetic philosophy from Japan, and that they really talk a lot about the difference between this Western ideal versus, like, an Eastern ideal, and they are different.
The Mushroom Grove, I've seen pictures of it out at the Hilton Garden Inn in Burlington. It's a series of tall structures, and you wouldn't say that they're not, you know, literal mushrooms, or,
right,
you know,
right,
but they suggest mushrooms. So describe, maybe you could describe them for us and how you came up with the idea.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's actually like a ongoing, I don't know, design almost, or an ongoing image that keeps circulating through the work I make. I make a lot of different types of sculpture, and I love material and a material exploration. So if you look at my work, you'll see a range of different things, a range of different imagery. But deep down inside, I'm like kind of a country boy. I was raised on a vegetable farm in Cabot, Vermont, and I was always spending my free time. There were not a lot of people, not a lot of like Vermont and Cabot specifically is such a beautiful place, but it's not like known for much more than cheese, as you can imagine. So I spent a lot of time walking in the woods and looking at, you know, ferns and mushrooms and trees. Of course, we had this sort of biological necessity to understand how plants grow and survive or don't, working on our parents' farm. So those mushroom pieces were really inspired by those walkabouts I would take in high school, just looking for, I guess, striking natural things in the landscape that were, you know, completely surprising. If you walk through the woods and if it's the middle of summer and really hot and rainy and you come across like some of those hen on the wood and they're just like bright neon yellow on a log that's completely decaying and brown,
yeah.
It's a completely spellbinding experience. So that's sort of where it began for me. And then since then, it's been, you know, a material and a just like a sculptural exploration. These pieces are, like you said, there are these three kind of sailboat mast structures that I made with, again, this fabricator, Matt Penny, my friend and shopmate. We made those all out of wood. We cut them all up with table mm-hmm. saws and glued them all together with some resin. And then they suspend on them 15 feet off the ground these sort of floral, sinewy-looking abstract forms that are all steel, painted steel and fiberglass. So they are durable. They are very shiny. They do respond to light, you know, sunlight. They kind of have a different feel at different parts of the day. To me, that's one of the most amazing assets about public art or art in nature is that the world becomes, you know, it's like such a dynamic experience to see something that you've made change with like rain, sunlight, or darkness even. I don't mean like change, like decay, just like change throughout the day. Like every second it looks different, which is really an exciting possibility.
Elliot, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. Yeah.
Elliot Katz is an artist in Burlington whose public art is on display at the Hilton Garden Inn in Burlington. It's just been talking about it, called The Mushroom Grove. We've got a number of comments to pass along from people who wanted to recommend public art. Karen Lane, who is the longtime library director at the Aldrich Library in Barrie, wants to point people toward a sculpture of Mr. Pickwick that's now on the Aldrich Library front lawn. It was a masterpiece, she says, by Barrie sculptor Giuliano Cecinelli. And by good fortune, she says, there is an exhibit of Cecinelli's career as a sculptor that opens today at Studio Place Arts in Barrie, and a reception coming up this Thursday. Barrie is just a rich, rich place for art. Jim Davis of Westport, New York writes, I always enjoy the two flukes of the whales on Route 89 between Burlington and Williston. They've been there many years and are a tribute to someone or some organization. I'd be interested to know to whom goes the credit. We compared notes on this before, unless, Rachel, you have something to add. I know they were made by sculptor Jim Sardonis, and I know they were in Randolph for many years, and many of us feel they worked much better down there. But that's perhaps another program. You know, one thing that comes to mind in thinking about public art is there's always room for controversy, because there are so many different opinions on art. Is that something, you know, art can be political, it can be provocative. Do you see examples of that, or is that something that's generally avoided in public art? Rachel?
The first thing that comes to mind, there's certainly controversy, and I think sometimes it's avoided and sometimes, you know, it's welcomed and invited, and that's maybe part of the point. I know with the filing cabinet work, which is called File Under SoCo Waiting For, I believe it's the tallest filing cabinet in the world. I don't know. But that was created by Bren Alvarez in response to the Champlain Parkway project, and was, you know, a very pointed comment about sort of city bureaucracy. And I'm sure that that ruffled a few feathers. So that example comes to mind. I also know that, to go back to Middlebury, that the collection there was in large part spearheaded by Richard Saunders, after a work by Vito Acconci was vandalized. It upset students and faculty and was burned down. And he, you know, has dedicated a huge amount of time and effort to not only restoring that work, which is now fully restored, but to building a collection.
I was reading in 7 days, Rachel, about a mural on a mobile station in Burlington that some people objected to, and it was changed. It was nothing, you know, obviously offensive about it. It was just a design, I guess, that people didn't like. And I remember, too, the Ledyard Bridge, which goes between Hanover and Norwich. There are these large concrete balls on the bridge that some people found aesthetically displeasing. Again, Michelle, you know, because of the collaborative nature and the public nature of this art, are we just inclined to see things that aren't going to provoke or cause controversy?
Well, I don't think controversy is necessarily bad. If it engages people in a dialogue about what they value about their place and what their community will look like, I think that's a good thing. You know, not everyone is going to like what the outcome is, but that's true in any public process for any public project, you name it. There's going to be someone who doesn't like it, but the dialogue, I think, is important.
All right. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you both for being here, Rachel Elizabeth Jones from 7 Days and Michelle Bailey from the Arts Council. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Coming up, VPR's Taylor Dobbs on what you should know about alternative regulation. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind. The job of regulating utilities and telephone companies falls to the Public Service Board, and the Public Service Department represents consumers and ratepayers before the board. That's how the system is set up. The board is quasi-judicial, which typically means deliberations bear some similarities to court proceedings. But in the case of two Vermont utilities, the regulation is a bit different. It's called alternative regulation. VPR's Taylor Dobbs has been reporting on how it works, and he joins us now to provide us with details. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Steve.
Well, to start off, you know, maybe contrast how traditional regulation works or explain how it works and what its drawbacks are.
Sure. So, I mean, to start with, utilities are regulated because they naturally have monopolies over their customers. You know, most people who have Green Mountain Power can't get their power elsewhere. And the same is often true for things like, I mean, definitely natural gas and other power companies around the state. And so the state regulates these utilities essentially to mimic what it would be like in a competitive market environment. And the driving premise of that is that utilities shouldn't be charging customers more than it costs the utility to serve those customers. And they go about that basically by keeping a close eye on the finances of the utilities.
So why do we need a different form of regulation? Based on what you describe, it sounds like it ought to work.
Right. So one of the problems with traditional regulation is that there are some costs that will change pretty regularly throughout the year, things like the wholesale cost of electricity. And when those costs change, the utilities weren't allowed under traditional regulation to pass those on to customers. So if the cost of electricity for Green Mountain Power went up, they weren't allowed to charge their customers more for that electricity under traditional regulation. And so alternative regulation creates a mechanism where they can make some narrow adjustments to their rates throughout the year based on changing business costs to them.
So how does alternative regulation work in a way that might present some issues and is different from traditional?
So in a traditional rate case, it's a lot like a court proceeding, as you mentioned. Both sides present testimony. There's cross-examination. Things are, you know, sworn testimony, and it's open to the public. And it takes place in a court-like room, and a witness is on a stand, and you can watch it all play out. Alternative regulation is a lot more similar to like a settlement negotiation out of court. So both the Department of Public Service, representing the Vermont public and ratepayers, will go to the utility, and they will work out, okay, how much did it really cost you to serve customers, and how much of that is an appropriate amount to be passed through to those customers in rates. And they'll put together a rate proposal that then goes to the Public Service Board for approval, but there isn't that sort of open court process where there's testimony and cross-examination and that kind of thing.
You mentioned Green Mountain Power and Vermont Gas as the two utilities that are regulated under alternative regulation, Taylor. Why just them?
Well, utilities can opt into this, and that's a question I've been wanting to explore with my reporting, because it's not abundantly clear why you would choose one over the other as a utility. But it is noteworthy that those are the only two utilities in the state using alternative regulation, and they're sister companies. They're both owned by the Canadian firm Gaz Metro.
If you were just explaining a minute ago, alternative regulation allows companies to do more without regulatory approval. What is and isn't then regulated in this approach?
So all of the same things are regulated under alternative regulation, but the way they do that is different. And the questions to be asking with things like utility investments or things that aren't changing overhead costs, the question is, how closely is this spending monitored and how strictly are the rules being followed to get those costs from utility spending and then put into rates that customers then have to pay? Are regulators making sure that all of those cost pass-throughs are appropriate? And then the second thing that regulators have a lot of control over is which costs can be changed without a rate case. You know, there's a very narrow definition of alternative regulation that would allow just changing wholesale power costs to be passed through to customers without a rate case. But then there's other things that could be passed through that are outside the company's control, like it's a warm summer and people are using less power, and so the company should be allowed to put its rates up to collect more money. And that would be another possible use of alternative regulation.
So from a consumer standpoint, for those who are, let's say, customers of a company that's under alternative regulation, why should this matter?
Well, I mean, this should matter in large part because from a consumer standpoint, very few people have a choice in what utility they go to. So if you're paying bills for Green Mountain Power or for Burlington Electric or, you know, these other utilities, you have to pay whatever they're charging. And so making sure that the state is properly regulating those and following the rules that are set out in state law and in past precedent, that's important because that's the only way that Vermonters have to make sure that they're getting a fair deal.
Who's critical of this system as it stands at this point, the alt regulation system?
Well, one of the big critics, probably the main critic, is AARP. And that might seem weird to some people because that's the retiree lobby. But they're really focused on this because they say their members are more sensitive to changing bills because a lot of older people who are retired are on a fixed income. And so they disagree on a pretty fundamental question about what the Department of Public Service and the Public Service Board are supposed to do. They say that they should really be driving hard for the lowest possible bills. And then on the other side, the Department of Public Service is arguing that not just the lowest possible bills, but they have to meet the state's energy priorities. And so if you want the lowest possible bills, you buy like coal power on the open market. That's way cheaper than something like solar. But the Department of Public Service would say, well, Vermonters have decided that we want to also be environmentally friendly. We have this renewable 90% renewables by 2050 goal. And in order to meet those, we have to make some decisions that aren't necessarily the cheapest.
You know, so we've got an alternative regulation system, which, as you've explained, might not provide for the same same transparency as traditional regulation because there isn't that court-like judicial process in place. Yet the advantages are its ability to perhaps be more responsive because it's more ongoing and less periodic than traditional regulation. That apparently played into changes that occurred when the UK's Brexit vote took place, right?
That's right. This was a really interesting one, and it's sort of just an accident of timing. But all utilities have to build into their rates the things that make up their whole system, things like power lines, trucks, utility poles. And instead of making customers pay for those things as the utility buys them, it's sort of like an annuitized repayment, and that's called the return on equity. And the return on equity is a percentage of all the things that the company owns. And for Green Mountain Power, that rate, which they are allowed to charge customers, is set by the 10-year Treasury bond. and specifically how that bond is performing for 1 month over the summer. And it just happened to be that that month over this summer happened right when Brexit happened. And so the 10-year Treasury bond was in the toilet with all the financial markets. And so Green Mountain Power's return on equity went down. And that makes about $4.8 million in savings for customers.
And just to put this in context, how widespread is the use of alternative regulation outside of Vermont?
I don't know exactly how widespread it is, but it's definitely not unheard of outside Vermont. The key differences would be in those things that we were talking about earlier, and what costs are utilities allowed to pass through to customers without a rate case? Is it just things like the wholesale cost of power, or would it also be other things like weather and you know, some more factors that could make a less risky environment for utilities?
VPR's Taylor Dobbs. Thanks, Taylor.
Thank you.
You can read Taylor's coverage of the alternative regulation stories on VPR's website at vpr.net. That's Vermont Edition for today. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Steve Zinn. Thanks a lot for listening.